On today's episode of the S-Car podcast, exploring diversity and inclusion, we are talking with JJ Fogata, a highly experienced practitioner in diversity and inclusion.
Don't know about that.
Who practiced for a number of years in Uganda with the Peace Corps. Right. And is now back studying with S-Car in the master's program. Mm-hmm. And we have today a free flow conversation. I thought it would be kind of fun for us to sit down
in a parking lot
recording with no structure whatsoever.
Oh God.
JJ has no idea any of the questions that are going to be asked, and frankly I don't have any idea the questions I'll ask either. Our challenge over this podcast is simply the topic diversity and inclusion, and to explore that together. So, JJ, welcome.
Thank you.
Yes,
that was a great introduction.
Well, thanks so much.
It sounded really like legit. Yeah.
Well, I'm super excited to be talking with you because mm-hmm. I have to tell you, you are someone who has inspired me as probably the person in my life that I know who has the most experience and passion for the topic of diversity and inclusion. Hmm. So I'm interested, one of the things that we're working on in our class this semester is working on creating inclusive communities, and how can we bring more diversity and inclusion, or be successful in diversity and inclusion efforts at S-Car. And let's just start there. What are some things that you've seen, some things that you've pondered? What's your thoughts?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. My first year entering the S-Car graduate program, I didn't think I had a racialized lens, right? Like, I wasn't looking through. I was looking through purely like, this is a master's program that I'm going to come into. I'm going to finish it. I'm going to get those two extra letters next to my name that's going to help me get that job that, you know, I want to get, and that career that I want to have. I didn't even realize I wanted to work in diversity and inclusion until I entered Peace Corps. So when I came back from Peace Corps, after working extensively on how to build more diverse and inclusive communities at an organizational level, I started really looking at my experiences at S-Car through a racialized lens. And I started to realize that I was the only Asian American openly gay student. And at the time, the socio-political context outside of S-Car was really heated. I mean, it was when Trump was elected. I mean, yeah.
Is that when you started S-Car, right at that same time
period? No.
2016-ish?
No, I started S-Car at 2015.
Okay.
Because the way the program works is it's a master's international program, right? So you do your first year at S-Car with specific coursework that's required before you enter the field, and the field being Peace Corps. So some of those courses were critical self-reflection, the reflective practice course, of course, intro to conflict analysis, and the foundational theories courses. And then when I went to Peace Corps, a lot of those theories actually applied to some of the problems and issues that Peace Corps volunteers, particularly Peace Corps volunteers of color, were experiencing, both at a training and at a service level. And that's when I really threw myself into the work.
So you weren't sent into the Peace Corps as the diversity and inclusion guy. This is something you picked out on your own as you were there to move into.
Yes. No, I was not.
Wow.
And one of the big things that stood out to me was it was a predominantly white cohort with probably five or six volunteers of color, and their training, right, has a lot to do with cultural integration, how to integrate into the culture, how to have proper coping mechanisms to culture shock, and the training was written clearly for a white audience, so it wasn't speaking to us as volunteers. And I remember, sorry, I'm just going to be really transparent here. Before we leave, before we leave to serve in Uganda or whatever post you're assigned to, you have a 2-day training, right, in either Philadelphia or New York. We were placed in Philadelphia, and it's sort of like a pre-service training, and it's like your last chance to bail. So I walk into the training session, And a Peace Corps recruited itself, like, the way the recruitment person described Peace Corps was that it was a very diverse and inclusive organization, and it was representative of the diversity of America. And I walked in to the hotel, and I was like, oh, this is interesting. Even though I just said I'm not looking through a racialized lens, right? Like, particularly when it came at that point in my life. But that was the first time where I was like, wow, I'm the only person of color. And I go, maybe tomorrow when everyone shows up, it won't be such a predominantly white audience. Not that, and we can discuss why I feel that's an issue or was an issue when I was serving. The next day, two women of color, I overheard their conversation, and basically it was like, oh, it's a blizzard up in here. And I go, oh, I know exactly what, that's a symbolic language. It's a blizzard, lots of white people. And we were like, okay, you know, I was still optimistic. I was trying to walk in with, you know, an open mind and yeah, just, I came there to serve, right? This was my goal, ultimately, was just to serve in Peace Corps and not pay so much attention to who I was serving with, particularly the American volunteers.
Can I ask you a question real quick?
Yeah.
I'm really curious. So I as a white male, have not gotten to experience what it's like to walk into a room, to a blizzard, and have the personal impact that may have. I'm curious, is it like a fear? Is it a hesitation, a nervousness, I can see that I'm not represented here? Like, what's the feeling that happens when you're, you know, thrown into an environment like that?
Well, okay, so first, that's an environment I've lived in. I'm used to it. It's not a shock to me. I think I lived in a predominantly white neighborhood growing up when I immigrated to this country. And again, at that age, like, again, you're not looking through a racialized lens. It's usually brought to your attention. And we can talk about that story. That's kind of sad, kind of funny. But there's a feeling of isolation. There's an expectation that I'm going to have to be the representative voice of the Asian community. There's an anxiety that I felt, almost this, like, I wanted... I don't know. So it's this feeling, I can compare it to, right, like media, right? You're watching television.
Right.
And when I see a person that looks like me, I don't even know what that feeling's like. Like, it is like, whoa, like, that feels so cool.
Like, it stands out to you.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. It stands out to me. Like, especially when it's not a problematic representation of the Asian American community. When I see it in media, which is very rare, or when I see it in magazines, and when I see it in real time, it feels almost this, like, sense of, like, comfort. Like, okay, I'm not the only one.
Wow.
I'm not the only one. And actually at SCAR, I felt that, because I can only speak from experience. I haven't met many Asian American students at SCAR, and we can really deconstruct the reasons why I think that's the case. But when I see fellow Asian Americans or Asian people like around campus, particularly within the SCAR environment, I don't know what that feeling is. I can't really describe it. It's like, oh, so I'm not the only one.
Is there like a comfort there?
It's comfort. Yeah. It's like, okay, cool. Like, I'm not going to be the only one.
Yeah.
So when that's not the case, and I mentioned it already, there's this feeling like, oh, I feel a little isolated.
Yeah.
I feel a little isolated.
Do you think that isolation might cause you to not put as much of yourself into a program like SCAR, you know, and anywhere? Let's just say any organization out there. If you feel like there's not representation, like similarities, something to that effect, do you feel like it causes you to retract some from the environment? Do you feel like maybe you don't bring your full self into that environment?
Well, I mean, if I can, like, so the perspective that I'm taking with that question is Peace Corps, right?
Right.
So, yeah, I would retract. I'd be like, this is not an organization that I want to work for.
So that's super interesting. So for me personally, one of the biggest things that I've been wrestling with is I'm trying to develop this elevator speech for quickly, like, why, like, I can talk to anyone and tell them why it is so important for diversity and inclusion to be incorporated into organizations, schools, whatever the environment might be.
Right.
And I really want, like, those tangible kind of words that I can articulate why. And I think one of the things that you're hitting on there is if you have someone who brings their full self into an environment, they come with their own education, their own background, their own skills.
Right.
But if they are put into an environment that they can't completely, you can't completely leverage that full person, you for that organization, that academic institution, whatever it might be,
yeah,
you're not going to get everything you possibly could from everyone in the population of that school, and therefore it brings everything down.
Right.
Like it's so important.
Yeah.
For diversity and inclusion to happen.
Well, and as a teacher, like I want to be clear here. I don't know if this is something I should say, but when it comes to Peace Corps and you're sharing stories about Peace Corps, we have to say that my view is not representative of the organization. Like, these are only my views, and that I can't speak for the entire organization because I served in one particular post at one particular period of time with a particular cohort. So I don't want to make, like, the danger of, like, the single story of the Peace Corps volunteer. Like, there was a lot of transformative work that was done. So I feel like I have to say that.
That was a great disclaimer.
Right. I also...
You should be a lawyer.
A lawyer? Oh, no thank you. Sorry for those lawyers out there. just not my preference of career. And that segues, I mean, that deals with sort of my professional experience has been in the classroom, and what you're saying, or what I think I'm hearing, is any school, from preschool all the way to higher education, my personal, what I want to accomplish as a teacher is to introducing the world into the classroom, right?
That's cool.
Like, the world is changing. Your classroom should be representative. Your teacher should be representative of the world that you're living in. And our world is not insulated.
Yep.
Right? We can choose to, but the reality of it is it's changing. And we're going to come across people with different perspectives, people that don't look like us, that don't speak like us. And, any opportunity to engage that type of environment where it's not otherizing or where it's not creating this, like, enemy image of the other, I think is, like, not only the job of teachers, but just of, I don't know, anybody, if that makes any sense, right?
It makes total sense. I mean, I think when you see someone else that is someone that you might otherize, I love that word, by the way.
Right.
I mean, as horrible of a representation of what it actually stands for.
Yeah.
Others that you might otherize, if you see that as opportunity to, like, become more well-rounded, to learn from someone else, to gain a whole nother perspective and to share your own.
Right.
And that's kind of how, I like what you're talking about, bringing the world into the classroom.
Yeah.
And anywhere, you know, that's awesome.
Yeah, and what's crazy is with Peace Corps, talking about Peace Corps, so what happened was, I'm coming into this organization really focused on making sure that I do meaningful work, grounded in critical self-reflection, making sure that I incorporate the things that I learned at SCAR that will stick with me for the rest of my life, like the white savior industrial complex, like not making sure that there's not this problematic, which I think, I don't even know how to put it.
Just go for it.
Right, white savior industrial complex. We're not here to save anybody, right? We're, a lot of Peace Corps volunteers, what they come in thinking that they're making this difference, but they realize that more, they were changed more than what they thought they were going to change the community, right? If that makes any sense, sorry. I'm functioning on 30 minutes of sleep, so apologies to whoever, all five of you that are listening to this. I'm just kidding.
What are you talking about? This is a top podcast.
I know.
Top
are you 10. Kidding? We're trending right now. Diversity inclusion is so, like, a hot topic. And, sorry, we can talk about that later, too.
Actually, that's something that concerns me.
Yeah.
Because I feel like diversity and inclusion is being incorporated in inauthentic ways.
We're capitalizing off of it.
Capitalizing off of it and also incorporating it in ways that are not truly productive.
Right.
Because and we need to hit a mark. We're going to set what that mark is. We're going to hire X many, you know, this many people into the organization. Once we hit it, bam, we're diverse. Cool.
Right.
We hit the mark.
Right.
I think there's a whole lot more to it than that.
Yeah, and you can be diverse, but not inclusive.
Yeah.
So, what I was trying to get at was, because I'm being really tangential right now, SAT word. Before my cohort, there was only one woman of, from my understanding, one woman of color that spoke truth to power about the training and just the overall structure of Peace Corps at post needed to talk about race, diversity, and inclusion more because volunteers of color felt like they weren't having a voice.
How was that received?
Not well.
Really?
So the way Peace Corps works, or at least at the post, is you are given an all volunteers at the time trainees, right? Because we're being trained before we actually go to our site to serve, are given an evaluation of the training, right? So, and I'm hesitant to, like, speak for other people and stuff. Like, I want to make sure that I'm only speaking from my experience, but essentially, the evaluation was rating Peace Corps high in terms of their technical training, and for rooms of improvement, that was a suggestion. Like, maybe we should expand our training curriculum to speak to volunteers of color who are going to experience cultural integration very differently from a white volunteer because of the white savior industrial complex, right? If we're going to bring it back to that. And someone has to sign off on that evaluation. Like, as like, okay, we got this. Like, we agree that this is what we need to do to improve our training, and there was resistance to sign.
Wow.
Based off of the suggestion to talk about race, diversity, and inclusion within our post. Okay. Wow. And this was not to my knowledge at all when I was entering the training. As a volunteer, I found out about this after I essentially started the shit show and chose to speak and was like, this is not okay.
Yeah.
This is really problematic language that we're using here. Not only are we primordializing the communities in which we are going to serve eventually after this training, primordializing communities as in literally speaking about Ugandans in a really awful sort of primordialized way.
Like, it's kind of like better than language, or like, is it like kind of objectifying the Ugandans?
Yeah. I mean, one of the biggest initiatives that I took on while I was in Peace Corps was making sure that people asked for consent when taking selfies and pictures with not only people in the communities in which they serve, but random Ugandan people. And then posting it on social media, like, that was a huge problem, and it was never brought up. I mean, maybe it was, but not at a, like, institutional level. People were distraught by it, but I don't think really brought it to anybody's attention, like, senior management or whatever. So just a lot of things. Like, that training was really, really hard. And I started to realize, like, wow, this is going to be the bulk of my work while I'm serving in Peace Corps. Granted, I did do a lot of work as, like, a teacher and as, like, what I was thought I was going to be assigned to when they placed me in Uganda, but a lot of it was organizational work surrounding diversity and inclusion, because I not only felt the pain, but I shared that pain with the few volunteers of color mm-hmm. that were serving with me. And we sort of banded together and were like, we do not want anyone to feel what we're feeling after, like, that the people that come after us.
Yeah.
So we're going to try to really improve the training so that it speaks to every person that's entering service.
I'm kind of curious, did you have any successes outside of those of color that you were serving with? Like, with some of the white volunteers as well? Like, were you able to build a community that crossed racial lines and kind of
yes.
build awareness? And if so, I think one of the things I'm curious about, especially since we're looking into creating inclusive communities, what made that successful? Like, was there something in particular that yeah. brought about an inclusive community?
That's an interesting question, right? Because I immediately was like, yes, because I was brought back to, like, the people I still keep in contact with who are the embodiment of what it means to be an ally, right? But they already entered the program, entered the training with the knowledge of, like, diversity and inclusion, topics surrounding race are important conversations to have. So they already had that before applying to Peace Corps. So one of the things that we discussed was, like, why isn't this part of the pre-service training? Like, why isn't this, why are people coming in to this organization not knowing about microaggressions, not knowing about problematic language, and not knowing the implications of race and, diversity and inclusion within organizations. So it's not even crossing. Your question was, like, was there ever a time where you were able to build an inclusive community right. with, you know, with white volunteers? I would say 90% it was resistance. A lot of people resisted those conversations.
Is it like open resistance? I mean, is it passive, where people just choose not to hang out together?
It is.
Or was it like, I'm not hanging out with you because you don't look like me?
I mean, that's interesting. Every session has an evaluation that people write, all the trainees write, right? So I was facilitating experiential learning and diversity and inclusion. The resistance with several volunteers, and then there are anonymous evaluations, it was very open, as in, Justin makes me feel bad for being white. Like, it's not my fault that I'm white. And that is a reflection of maybe my facilitation. That's a learning lesson that I need to take on, right? Looking back on it. What did I do or say, or in what way did I not create an environment where people felt comfortable, not comfortable, but felt open and authentic in discussing their own position of privilege and power. There was definite resistance. But what's interesting is the way that it was reported out to the larger Peace Corps cohort, right? Because there were three cohorts, the health cohort, the education cohort, and that agribusiness cohort. So there was about, I don't know the specific number, but I think it was like 254 volunteers.
Wow.
Our cohort had 33, right? And
and you said there were five or six individuals of color.
Right.
And the rest were white.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a small percentage.
Right. But the way that those facilitations and the way diversity and inclusion was being described in our training when I was the facilitator and trainer for it, it was being communicated like that it was received very well, that we were making big strides, like significant strides in discussing those topics within the cohort. But then you would hear, right? You would hear what volunteers would say outside of that environment, and it was a very contentious, it was a contentious environment. Yeah.
So, what if you were to go back right now?
Mm-hmm.
Facing those same communities, the individuals who are writing that as their, you know, their own experience, how would you engage with them differently now?
Oh, I mean,
and I feel a little bit, I feel like I'm asking that question in a way where maybe it's coming off sounding as though I assume, or it sounds as though I'm assuming you have some kind of responsibility to change them, which I'm not trying to get at that. I'm just curious if there would be different behaviors you would take on in your interactions with them in hopes of building out a more inclusive environment, like knowing that these individuals would have that type of resistance.
Right.
Would you change anything, or would it be...
So I always came from a place of... I really tried to understand where the resistance was coming from. And honestly, there were so many things that we needed to discuss in terms of cultural integration, our reasons for serving. And I get it. Like, I understand the fragility. I understand the defensiveness. And I don't know what I would have done differently, to be honest.
You just struck something with me. I think there's an important point that having those types of discussions requires, or may require, a lot of times I think does require, a deep relationship to have already been built.
Yeah.
And yet, it's like this catch-22, because you can't build those relationships as deep as they need to be to discuss those topics.
Right.
Until you get to have those conversations. But you can't have the conversations until you have the relationship. And so you're kind of like... stuck.
Yes, and you know, there's also that, right, and I think
I
think what was hard was I was introduced as a trainer and a lead facilitator, and I was facilitating topics that were very sensitive and really spoke to people in ways that, you know, they wouldn't necessarily want to be open with me, because they're like, oh, he, you know, Justin is a trainer, like,
yeah,
you know, how am I going to have this conversation with him? When really we were very much, like, the power differential was not, like, crazy. Like, I felt like we could have very well established relationships during the training, but I think that title and that impression that I had some sort of power or leadership in the training, in the pre-service training, I think really prevented people from sitting down and having honest conversations, conversations with me.
So, like, almost like a need. So, and like an organizational change, like flattening the structure,
right,
and removing the hierarchical components, may have facilitated more ease amongst all parties to have those conversations.
Right, and honestly, I feel like they shouldn't use volunteers to talk about this stuff. They should have hired external consultant, like external trainers.
Yep.
Because I had my other shit I had to do. Like, I had this training took you out of your site. So, it started to, oh gosh, I am so sorry. Like, this is starting to come off as like, oh man, he just really could not stand his Peace Corps service. Absolutely not. The question that I get all the time, despite all the turmoil that happened and while I was serving, I would do it again. So that's like a question people ask, right? When you come back, like, would you do it again? And I mean, my first 3 months, I was like, hell to the no, I would not do that shit again. But now looking back, I'm like, yeah, absolutely, I would do that again. So I want to make that clear. But yeah, volunteers have their main project, their primary project,
right,
where they were called to serve, right? So then they're using volunteers who are people of color, the very few people of color, to lead facilitations on diversity and inclusion. And it's taking time and effort away from their primary project, because you know what? If you were to hire an external trainer that doesn't have any sort of bias or whatever, that costs money.
Yeah.
So they weren't...
Is there a pretty limited budget?
They were not paying... I don't know. But they were not... I remember being like, this is intense. Like, I didn't realize that my volunteer experience would be dedicated to this. Like, dedicated, literally, blood, sweat, and tears. Literally. Blood, sweat, and tears into this organization. And trying to improve something that I guess naively, like, I had some naivete. I thought I was gonna walk into an organization that really was representative of America, and really volunteers that did engage in critical self-reflection, and that's why I owe it to SCAR, actually. I would have had a completely different experience coming into Peace Corps if I didn't have those classes.
So, well, that's an interesting point, because I'm sure a lot of the volunteers that were there, and I think you said this earlier, didn't understand those concepts going mm-hmm. into the Peace Corps. And I think there's a whole lot of the population that doesn't have the luxury of...
Absolutely.
Have
the privilege.
...been presented the knowledge that you've been able to be exposed to.
Right.
And so I think that's another curiosity that I always have with it, is that there's all these amazing papers that have been published and books that have been written and experts in the field, and yet all of their learnings and words of wisdom, it's so difficult to take it and distill it down into something that can be disseminated into easy to digest public consumption.
Right.
It's like a lot of this takes a lot of work.
Right.
And a lot of choice to impose the knowledge upon yourself. Go looking for the knowledge.
Right.
And learn this type of stuff. But how do you create communities where you've got people that are resistant, that are not only, maybe not even just not exposed to the information, but choosingly don't want to expose themselves to any type of information because right. it's outside of their core, you know, their own personal core set of beliefs.
Right.
And that's what, I feel like that's such a, like a crux of the situation. Like, how do you make it so that others choose to accept one another? Because I, like, you know, like you and I, we've both lived
right.
in a way where we've seen the benefits of that. We believe in that because we've felt it, we've seen it, and it's just, I don't know.
And choose to educate, right? So that was another issue too. People of color, I felt like I was carrying a burden, being like the representative of diversity and inclusion and having to educate people, not only from the SCAR sort of like, you know, it's important to engage in critical self-reflection, like there's this thing called the white savior industrial complex, right? Like there's all that academic mumbo jumbo or whatever, but then there's also like your lived experience, which I think is just as relevant and just as important.
Absolutely.
to hear, right? So there was so much pressure. I felt so much pressure and so much pain, having to carry that burden. So if any conversation, any attempted dialogue went really wrong in Peace Corps, one, I acknowledged it. I was really transparent. I said, this is actually a period where we can be productive. Like, let's sit in this discomfort, which I think was one of the few things that I was able to accomplish, right?
That's a tough space to be in.
It is. Right. Like, the first step is, like, having the conversation, right?
Yeah.
I always say this. I'm like, it is so hard to talk about race.
Yeah.
It is so hard to do this podcast because I'm literally tracking every single thing I'm saying with the idea that I'm going to say something really, really problematic, or that I'm going to hurt somebody's feelings, or that I'm going to come across a certain way. So I think a lot of the easy way out is to not speak at all. But one thing that I can attest to is it's important to speak. It's important to speak out. Like, right, Audre Lorde, your silence will not protect you, right? The commitment feels dangerous, but at the same time, a lot of good can come out of that. But it's a matter of cultivating that environment and finding the opportunities to do that. And I'm not sure if we did our best, because I just got an email recently from a volunteer of color, who I guess through the grapevine, the Peace Corps gossip mill, even though I'm not there anymore,
still in it.
I'm still in it. She was like, your name has been mentioned multiple times about how you know, you and the diversity committee, Peace Corps had a diversity committee, right, already problematic, but had a diversity committee that really worked hard to, one, build institutional memory in terms of the trainings that were more inclusive of volunteers of color, making sure that, that diversity and inclusion was a core value of Peace Corps, and that involves training, that involves the conversations that we're having before we enter service, all that stuff. We worked really hard to do that, and we had a country director that really supported us in that initiative. Unfortunately, the way Peace Corps works, I'm pretty sure this is across all posts, country directors can only serve 5 years, right? And this country director left. So, right, so I don't know what information was transferred over to the new country director, but essentially it's like they're starting all over again.
Oh my gosh.
Right. Yeah, so I just recently found that out. So that makes the work even that more difficult. The work in terms of pursuing a career.
So, I mean, that sounds like one of the important points in trying to define creating inclusive communities is continuity.
Continuity, and yeah, so, right.
Like that, having a champion who's at a, well, you have like the grassroots or the ground floor level efforts, and then having a champion at like the policy making level,
mm-hmm.
and then continuity there to ensure that you don't have to hit the reset button, which it sounds like they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's years lost.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. And so much energy. I mean,
it has to feel so frustrating.
Yeah. It was heartbreaking. I haven't even responded to that email because I was like,
"Well, you just did."
Oh, did I?
With our top 10 podcasts.
Oh, right. If you hear this, I am so sorry. I am literally fatigued. Compassion fatigue is so real right now. Right. And when I was saying, like, how can we create those opportunities? How can we establish those relationships? I mean, it's really hard when, I think the word is transient, right? Where, like, an organization like Peace Corps, you're there for 2 years, you leave, you never come back, you never, you know, right. Country directors that are there for 5 years, if there was I don't know how or to what extent our work was remembered or put back into practice, clearly not enough, because...
What about in the local population?
The local...
What about outside of the Peace Corps? You interacted with...
Oh, like...
In the local population, the Ugandans.
Yes.
Do you feel like any of the work there continues on?
Right.
Any of the work you did there continues on? Like, your teachings, your...
I would hope so. See, like, this could be a podcast that's, like, 5 hours long, and we're not gonna put you through that.
We actually have a 45-minute limit.
Okay. So. Right. So... There's
Which is
so
totally
much.
Self-imposed.
Yeah, there's so much. There's so much, right? One of the trainings that we wanted to, or that we did, that I tried to facilitate, was what it means to serve, right? And, like, what context in which we're serving, like, neocolonialism, topics of neocolonialism, and what it means to be a Peace Corps volunteer in this country, and... what type of narrative, what type of story is already imposed upon us as a U.S. government agency coming in to quote-unquote help,
mm-hmm.
right? So when you're talking about, you know, the community outside of Peace Corps, the communities in which we sought to serve with, I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure because if... What it sounds like to me is all of the work that we did that really, at the end of the day, encouraged critical self-reflection as practitioners, right? I addressed the trainees, I used that word. I'm like, you are all practitioners of peace, okay?
Wow.
Like, yes, we're called volunteers, but you are practicing. You are a practitioner when you go out into the field eventually. So one of the biggest things that I took away from SCAR was engaging in critical self-reflection. And that was totally not a thing. I would say for the most part. And I don't think it continued. Because people are still taking them damn pictures, posting it on their Instagram, not asking for consent. Oh my gosh, yeah. People are still describing this, like, one... this, like, this danger of a single story, that's Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, I'm sorry if I pronounced that wrong, but this danger of a single story of, like, Africa as a country versus a continent, like, that type of problematic language is what I'm trying to, what I tried to prevent.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Which I think that's a common perception. Having grown up in America and... hearing the common narrative, I think the Africa as a country is not.
Mm-hmm. And so right, right, and there's that whole idea, right, about
wow.
I don't know in terms of how I can like connect this with diversity and inclusion, but that fear to speak, right? When I came back from Peace Corps. I didn't want to talk about the work that I did because it's so difficult to have these types of conversations. And I would hear that really problematic language from people who were curious about my experiences in Uganda, right? This idea of like, did you see lions? Like, oh my God. I'm starting to sound really sassy. But it's that idea of like, how can you compassionately call out people and make it a moment, a learning opportunity without defenses being built up? And I think that is a theme and a consistent experience with people trying to talk about diversity and inclusion. In what ways can we hold each other compassionately accountable? And the operative word there is compassionately accountable. Right, compassionate, without this feeling of like pointing fingers or making people feel like they're ignorant or uneducated or are coming from a place of like malice and things like that. That whole fragility, that whole fragility conversation is so difficult.
Yeah, it'd be pretty easy to approach somebody on something you heard that maybe you have more education on and. Kind of challenge them in a way that they could become so defensive that they would not be able to learn from it.
And yeah.
I have to say, we're doing this podcast right now, and there's an amazing raptor that has just flown directly in front of us.
Raptor?
Yes. Bird of prey.
Oh, I was like a dinosaur.
No. I'm sorry. Like a falcon.
that's scary.
That is absolutely incredible.
No, but so you brought something up that is, I think, important is time, right? Time is so important, like the ability to have the time and the space to talk about this stuff, right? And the energy to spend that time, the effort to spend that time to really make it a learning opportunity, because when people ask me problematic questions about my service in Uganda, like, right, where my compassion comes from is like, of course I'm gonna get asked questions like that. If that's the predominant narrative that everyone is working off of, like Lion King from, you know, like, that's my favorite Disney movie. Like, of course you're gonna ask me if I saw Rafiki, and that's like so problematic and really frustrating. But it's like, if I brought up that conversation, if I tried to make it a learning opportunity, that's going to be like a 30-minute to an hour conversation.
Yeah.
Right? When really they just want me to confirm that Africa is X, Y, and Z, or that Uganda was, and that's why I don't talk about it. That's why I don't talk about it. When they're like, how was your Peace Corps experience? I'm like, it was something else. How much time do you got? That's actually what I do say that. I'm like, how much time do you have? Because if you don't have enough time to sit down with me and really talk about this, then I don't want to have the conversation.
So time and space.
Time and space.
Time and space. And both critical elements to building this understanding.
Yes, and being like, we're going to say really problematic things, even on my end. Like, we're going to feel uncomfortable. This is going to feel uncomfortable. And, yeah, being comfortable.
Do you think those conversations are better one-on-one first?
Absolutely.
You think it's better? Do you think it's more difficult to have a group setting and let people really, truly feel that they can make those dangerous statements?
Right. I mean, the more people in the room... So that's like the... that's the irony, yeah, right?
Like, the reason I'm asking is because there's... I know that there's folks from SCAR that are looking into creating those spaces mm-hmm. now. And another podcast where we talked to Pushpa Iyer, who was big on creating a space for some of the students out at Middlebury in Monterey.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like there's groups of individuals, but one of the curiosities that I had was, how do you get people there in the first place? And I wonder if it's those one-on-one engagements at first before you can bring people into the door. If there's a formula to this, you know right. what I mean? Like how we're looking for, how do we make this happen?
Right. Right. So, right. So this is like the irony of it all, right? And I try to somehow in class talk about this. The whole idea, like, everybody needs to be in the room, that those people, they all come in with different positions of power. There's so much implicit bias that's happening in the room that may prevent people from speaking, or prevent people from speaking truth to power. And I've experienced that myself. You know, I'm speaking from my own experience. And when your question is like, is it better one-on-one? Yes, for me. Yeah, I absolutely think so. But also the idea of caucusing, like, and people may interpret that as like segregating groups, but no, it's caucusing. Like, you know, this group of people comes and discusses topics of race and sort of their experiences surrounding privilege and power versus a group that discusses. And what ends up happening, at least what ends up happening is you realize the intra-group issues that come up. This is a really like complex thing to talk about, but we really flippantly use diversity and inclusion so easily. Like, we're just like, diversity and inclusion, woo! Yeah, United Colors of Benetton, like Gap ads with like an Asian person, like, yay! No, it's like a really complex, complicated thing to talk about and to address.
For sure.
Yeah. Like, as I'm talking, just being completely transparent. Hopefully you edit this, because it's reaching 50 minutes here.
We're not. It's going to be 50 minutes.
Oh, no!
It's a self-imposed timer. Our group, with our podcasts, decided that we wanted to do podcasts that would fit into a normal commute. So we were looking for the 25 to 35 minutes, no more than 45, for those that have a little bit longer of a commute. But you know what, JJ? You're such an important voice in this that... I'm gonna give you a little extra time.
So oh well,
we can wrap up in a minute.
Clearly,
or two. It's fine. But
probably a really abrasive voice too.
No, this is honestly. I think there are a ton of awesome learning points from just the conversation we've had today. Like, I feel like, and I think I've said this a couple times, but I feel like going back and looking. We talked about continuity. We talked about time and space. I think, again, like, in the exploration of creating inclusive communities and trying to define how can that happen. You've given a lot of wisdom as to how that can happen, and that's what we're trying to get to.
Right.
So,
and clearly this conversation's heated because your windshield's fogging up, Titus. That's another thing too. I just want to be very clear here. I am full-time graduate student, right? Trying to make ends meet. This conversation, I said it at the beginning, was like, I'm functioning on 35 minutes of sleep. So some of the things that I say are going to really come from a raw place.
That's
and
great.
The whole podcast format, I think, is interesting, because I really hope that I can engage. Like, if there's resistance to what I'm saying, or if somebody wants to call me out, right? I really hope there's that opportunity. I welcome it. I invite it.
Would you be so bold as to leave some type of contact information for those to potentially call you out?
Oh.
And seek to learn more? And if not...
Like the Office of the Inspector General at Peace Corps, that's like, what are you doing?
Tell you what, why don't I leave mine? And if they'd like to get in contact with you, they can reach you through me. How's that?
Yikes. Well, tell me who it is first.
No, I will. You'll have first right of refusal. So anyone listening to this podcast, if you'd like to have some more conversation, some deeper conversation surrounding this with JJ or with myself, contact me. My contact information is titus.mott, that's TITUS.MOTT, at masonlive.gmu.edu. And I welcome more conversation.
You think people will really listen to this while they're driving? Is that like a thing? Yeah, I don't really
think
podcast.
That's where a lot of people get
there. I am so sorry. I think I screamed at some points during
this. That's okay. This is free flow format. You can scream all you want. You can scream again. We can end the whole thing on a scream if you want.
If you're driving, pay attention to the road. Don't put other people in danger.
JJ, do you have anything you want to close with? Do you have any kind of, and if the answer is no, that's fine. Do you have like a go-to statement?
Absolutely.
What is it? Give it to me.
So a professor at SCAR told me this. A resistance is knowledge yielding.
A resistance is knowledge yielding.
Resistance is knowledge yielding.
Oh, resistance is knowledge yielding.
Yeah. So when you resist, you yield knowledge.
Wow.
Yeah. And I have experienced that time and time again. As much as it pains me to speak truth to power, to choose courage over comfort, right? Thank you, Brené Brown. To not be complicit. It's difficult. It's hard. But what comes out of it is something really beautiful. Even though at the beginning it's like extremely uncomfortable. I've come to really try to be comfortable with being uncomfortable.
So, so cool.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, JJ, thank you so much.
Yeah.
This is really cool. This is fun. Yes.
Was it fun?
Hopefully we'll get to do another podcast sometime.
We can
break out into some of the other, the other topics we started kind of just touching on today. Right. And maybe we can get a little deeper into it.
Yeah. And one more thing too. It's like when you're talking about this stuff, whatever. Oh, I see it. I see the thing you're talking about. The raptor is humor.
Maybe it's a hawk.
Humor
maybe
is
it's
so,
a red down hawk.
Humor is so huge, right? Humor is so huge. Just like laughing and
yes,
going off. So yeah. So Titus, you're gonna train me to become the next American Ninja Warrior. Hopefully, that's gonna be our next podcast.
Okay, we're gonna jump from diversity and inclusion to American Ninja Warrior, and that's a little teaser. Yeah. More to come.
Get ready. We're gonna do a podcast as we're climbing.
All right. Thanks, JJ. Appreciate it.
Yes.
All right.